Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why some migrants are choosing to claim asylum in Mexico rather than in this country, and Arizona Regent Fred Duvall on why he's concerned about top talent leaving the state's universities. But first, Arizona Democrats have ousted their party's chair just 6 months after electing him to the job. Robert Branscombe won January's election handily, defeating incumbent Chair Yolanda Bejarano. But things soured quickly, with the state's top elected Democrats saying Branscombe had lost their trust. And after a series of controversies, party activists voted him out last night on a vote of 476-56, achieving the needed two-thirds majority for removal. Cameron Sanchez from KJZZ's politics desk has been following this and joins me now to talk more about it. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
So this was a pretty overwhelming vote to oust him, just as I said, a few months after a pretty overwhelming vote to elect him.
Oof. Yeah, it was rough. So he won in what we called a landslide, and I think that's fair. And he lost not really in a landslide because it was a two-thirds vote required to do that.
Yeah.
But it was two-thirds of all of the state committeemen, and not all of those people showed up at the meeting. So 500 and something people showed up. And of those, it was like 480 or something voted to oust him.
Yeah.
So it was about 89% of the folks who showed up.
And of those Democrats who voted to remove Branscombe, what did they have to say about why they were voting that way?
They had a lot to say. So basically, almost ever since he got elected, there has been a lot of controversy and drama, whether it was with fundraising and how he was paying himself or his bad relationships with almost every single important elected Democratic official who have moved their operations elsewhere for all intents and purposes. So people had a lot of grievances to air. I think probably the main concern is just that the party is not functioning right now. The fact that the chair is not able to work with the Democrats who they need to get reelected. The fact that next year is a big election year. It's a midterm and they've got Trump in office, and that financially things are not going well for the party. All of that just made people think, I think, that they needed a change.
All right. So let's talk about sort of how we got here. You mentioned the party's finances, which mm-hmm. are not in great shape.
Mm-mm.
Also, Branscombe did not seem to really get along with, as you referenced, at least three of the top Democrats who need to get reelected or trying to get reelected next year. Katie Hobbs, Adrian Fontes and Chris Mays. So like, how exactly did we get here?
That's a good question. I mean, there's so much background on this. If you're interested, you know, we could talk about it for maybe an extra hour or so. It was basically starting around April, some communications came out that he was having beef with these Democrats, and they said he wasn't being transparent with them, that he wasn't working with them financially, and that donors were wary of getting involved. And there was a vote of no confidence him. He got censured. But none of that seemed to dissuade him from wanting to be the chair. He refused to step down. Even last night, he was saying, you know, I think that I should be here and I'm good at my job and it's not my fault. And mistakes were made, but we're going to be great going forward. And people, I think, just had lost their confidence.
Yeah. How exactly did he try to defend himself last night?
He said that he inherited issues coming into this job of being chair. And he said that they didn't have a plan initially, perhaps, but they do now, and the mm-hmm. plan is going to be great. But no, that didn't fly.
Well, and it's fair to note that he came into this not having been chair before, right? Like, he kind of came into this and had to hit the ground running, not necessarily having a lot of background at doing mm-hmm. it. But it also seems as though a lot of the folks who kind of knew how the party ran didn't stick around after he got elected.
Right. So if you remember in 2024, it was a really rough election year for Democrats. They lost almost every competitive race all the way up the ballot, all the way down the ballot. And so I think that was the reason that folks didn't want to keep Bejarano around, even though she wanted to be chair still.
Mm-hmm.
And Branscombe was kind of the alternative, who said, you know, I will be the change that we need. I will have this great plan. And then the plan didn't happen. So I think that was the reason for that.
So the Democrats elected in a what sounds like a temporary chair, but is there going to be a full vote for a brand new chair at some point?
Not elected so much as the vice chair ascended. So her name is Kim Corey, and she's going to be the interim chair. But yes, they are intending to have a vote for a new chair in probably September, sometime in the early fall.
And presumably that person is, I mean, let's talk about hitting the ground running. That's that's less than a year away from primaries and slightly more than a year away from the actual election.
Yeah, I've been putting out feelers for the past week and a half, and no one has said that they want that job. It's kind of a rough position to be in. If you say that Branscombe inherited problems, man, this person's going to inherit the tempest.
So I want to ask you also about one of the things that Branscombe and some of his defenders pointed to over the course of this controversy, which is the role of race. Branscombe is black, with the first black chair. And it sounds like he was not shy about suggesting that maybe racism was at play here.
He did say that, and he had a small coalition of supporters who were black leaders in the party who backed him. But those allegations have been denied by most everyone else who went after him. They said it was basically everything to do with his behavior and lack of transparency.
Does this in any way change a lot of elected officials' plans to sort of coordinate their campaigns through the Navajo County Democratic Party now that Branscombe is out?
That's a good question. And I had asked the head of the Navajo committee about that. And she said that she intends for it to be temporary. So just for this upcoming election cycle. But I think the bell has been rung, won't be unrung. I think that that is the fundraising plan going forward, at least for this next year. just because they don't have that much time to lose. I mean, in terms of elections, really, they don't have any time to waste here. And even if the party gets its finances together rapidly, I don't think it would be enough time.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. That is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez from the Politics Desk. Cameron, thanks.
Thank you.
We are used to seeing headlines about the southern border being overwhelmed with migrants seeking asylum. But right now, the border is the most quiet it's been in years. On his first day in office, President Trump ended asylum applications at the border, throwing out a Biden-era program that allowed migrants to apply for an asylum appointment via an app called CBP-1. The move left an estimated 270,000 people in Mexico who were waiting for their appointments with nowhere to go. Now, our next guest reports with nowhere to go. Many of them are changing tax and applying for asylum in Mexico instead. Daisy Zavala Magana is a reporter for the Nogales International, and she spoke more about it with my co-host, Lauren Gilger.
So for the last month, there's been kind of a standstill in terms of what we've been seeing with migrants arriving from Mexico or other countries. People aren't really arriving anymore like they used to. But the people who are here that stayed here waiting for CBP-1 before it shut down are now looking toward seeking asylum in Mexico to sort of find some stability as they hold on to hope that the asylum system in the U.S. will be fixed sometime soon, right? That they'll have a pathway.
Right. So the pathway to the U.S. is pretty much cut off at this point. So they're looking to Mexico instead. How is the Mexican asylum system handling this? How is the government responding there?
It's unclear if they're equipped, if Mexico is equipped to handle the increase in claims that have been filed. But reports from the LA Times and my own reporting here in Nogales, Sonora seem to indicate that they're not ready. Because under law, also, what's signifying this to us is that under law, the agency tasked with resolving cases, telling them yes or no, it's supposed to take 45 days. But right now in Nogales, Sonora, we're seeing wait times of 6 months to a year.
So taking a long time, and it sounds like there are some real kind of barriers in place for folks, challenges in applying for asylum in Mexico, just as they would have seen challenges applying in the U.S., right?
Yeah, it seems simple on paper. But what the attorney at the Kino Border Initiative in Nogales, Sonora was relaying to me is that when migrants from other countries arrive to Mexico, they have a window of 30 days where they're supposed to file their claims. They can still do it outside that window, but it just gets more complicated, more paperwork, more things that they have to do. And we don't have embassies here at our border. So they're risking having to drive further north without a regularized status, right? Without a legal status.
Right. So describe for us what life is like for migrants, undocumented migrants in Mexico on the Mexican side of the border. I mean, like, they're vulnerable in many ways, but are they also just vulnerable to deportation the way many migrants are being deported here in the U.S. right now?
In theory, yes. But what has been the practice in Mexico is that they'll deport them further south in Mexico. So maybe not to their country of origin, but just further south. But what I've been hearing from migrants that have been there and from the Kino Border Initiative is that they've faced a lot more violence in those regions than they might in somewhere like Nogales, Sonora.
Let me ask you, Daisy, about what this means for migrants in the country if they are able to seek asylum there and get it. I mean, does it give them long-term stability, short-term stability? Can they work if they don't have some kind of status like that?
Yes. So even just initiating the process gives them more stability than not, because they don't have to wait to receive word on whether they're approved or not to request what they call a humanitarian card, which will give them the ability to legally work. And while they're awaiting word for whether they're approved or not, they can also begin accessing healthcare and enroll their children in schools.
Right. So tell us about some of the families that you have met there. And they are families, like they have little kids there, right?
Yeah, it's been mostly families in terms of the people that have come to the border to seek asylum, with patterns of deportations that might be different. But with people requesting asylum, yes, a lot of families. And we're talking, you know, I've seen families with, you know, 2-month-old babies or several children that are elementary age or just school aged, and they've traveled through various countries to get here to the border.
So why do many of these families decide to stay in Nogales from the folks you've talked to? Like, do they feel like they cannot go home?
Yeah, basically out of options. They can't go home for people that are foreigners, and for people that are Mexican, they have felt a little safer in Nogales for one reason or another. Maybe if they have been fleeing from, say, criminal groups, Nogales, Sonora might be in a different corridor, as we would call it, so they might not have as much control to get knowledge of their whereabouts, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So as we're seeing the border basically shut down into the U.S., I wonder, like, it doesn't stop folks coming from, you know, unsafe places and unstable places in Central and South America, I'm sure. They seem to be coming to Mexico anyway. But are some giving up hope? Are they self-deporting?
What I've heard from Kino is that people have left, and it's kind of unclear exactly where. Maybe they stayed within Mexico, but they left Nogales because Nogales is known to not have a lot of job opportunities. So there really isn't economic stability for them here. But the reality is that they really don't have anywhere else to go.
All right, we'll leave it there. That is Daisy Zavala Magana, reporter for the Nogales International, joining us. Daisy, thank you for your reporting here. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a firsthand account of what it was like to be a child held in an immigrant detention facility along the U.S.-Mexico border. But first, Arizona's public universities will start their fall semesters in the next several weeks. But despite that calendar, there's still some uncertainty the schools are facing, most notably in terms of whether international students will be able to be on campus when classes start. I spoke earlier with Arizona Region Fred Duvall about some of the big issues facing the state's universities as the new semesters get underway next month. And we started on the state level with the new budget and how he thinks universities did in the new spending plan.
Well, Mark, appreciate the question, because we are grateful that we've turned a corner with our state funding partners. And for the first year in decades, we've had a significant positive step towards investment. And we just can't be more pleased with the bipartisan budget leadership that was able to make this investment of, in this particular case, $325 million in bonding authority, which enables us to build new facilities. And, you know, it follows literally, you know, 20 years of cuts. And so we were getting very fragile.
Obviously, 1 year of additional funding does not make up for, as you referenced, a couple of decades of cuts or no additional funding. But how much does this at least get you back on the right path?
Well, let me answer that two ways. First, to put the broader issue in context. And of course, you know, this is not critical to anybody who's there because this is over 20 years. We now fund our students at about half of what on a per student basis of what we did 20 years ago. We've doubled, more than doubled our enrollment. And that, you know, that's a reflection of that. So that's how big of a hole we had found ourselves in. But look, what does $325 million in what we call speed bonds mean? It means, you know, a gigantic step forward in an ASU medical school. It means a big step forward in NAU's commitment to grow nursing by 1,200 nurses, both of which we critically need. You know, the University of Arizona has got an array of technology-based and solutions-based infrastructure requirements that they need. So this is valuable dollars that will enable us to, you know, really drive forward the kind of workforce and solutions that Arizonans need.
Is that additional money and authority even maybe a little more important right now as universities, both here in Arizona and around the country, are dealing with the loss of federal research dollars? Understanding that it's not really an apples to apples comparison. The state money is not meant to backfill that. But, you know, the universities are dealing with a considerable amount less federal money. So I would imagine that any amount you get from the state right now is particularly helpful.
Yes, you're absolutely right. You know, I don't want to get too much into the weeds. The cutbacks which are occurring at the federal government, one of the areas is what's called indirect cost recovery. And that is the dollars which are not specifically involved in the research that the federal government is hiring us to produce, but is necessary to produce it.
Yeah.
And to the extent that we've got dollars for infrastructure, it definitely helps soften that impact.
Are you concerned about the university's ability to continue to do the kind of research that they've been doing over the last number of years?
Mark, I can't tell you how anxious I am about it. I mean, let me just put it into a broader perspective. Talent is mobile. It's not like, you know, resources in the ground. It moves. And so as we cut back on research and as we cut back on cancer research and technology research and the research that drives national security and research that drives new energy solutions, it will go elsewhere. And Australia and Canada and Europe are putting together research packages for talented researchers who can create those breakthroughs. It's what drives the 21st century economy. And you think about what's happened around Stanford and, you know, Silicon Valley. You think about what's happened in healthcare in Austin and in Boston, or, you know, UC San Diego. These are intellectual infrastructures that create new ideas that improve our qualities of lives and raise people's standard of livings as well. It all starts in the lab, and the lab is something which we need to continue to invest in, or others will.
I know that ASU and the U of A and NAU have long been sort of in competition for, as you say, you know, talent and innovators and scientists and researchers from other universities around the country. I wonder if what we're seeing now, and you just alluded to it, is that the pool of competition is getting bigger because other countries now are starting to recruit, you know, American researchers or researchers who have been doing their work in the U.S. So it's not just ASU, for example, might lose somebody to MIT or to Stanford. It's that they might lose a researcher or a scientist to a whole other country.
That's exactly right. And it is true both of researchers and I suspect this issue is on your list today, foreign students.
So let's talk about international students, because that, of course, is another issue that the Trump administration is looking to deal with and reduce the number of international students coming to American universities. What are the conversations like between the university administrators and the regents about what kind of impact this might have, not just on the schools themselves, but on the state?
Sure. So let me first note that the concern about national security is real. All of us, regardless of politics or party, should share the concern that students from foreign countries should be vetted for national security risks. I think that's a given. That said, what we don't want to do is disincentivize great students from coming to the United States. We are now approaching 50% of all of our of students in our Arizona universities are out of state. Now, that's not foreign students, but that's out of state students. 46% of the Fortune 500 companies were started by immigrants or their children. These are the brightest, most talented students in the world. We don't want to chase them away. So we've got to strike the balance. We've got to make sure that we do the necessary vetting, but do it quickly and efficiently. And in the context of creating a welcoming environment for the right students who do not have concerns to land here, succeed here, stay here, start businesses here, and put people to work here.
With classes starting, you know, in the next several weeks here at universities, what are you hearing about what the schools are doing and what some of those international students who are in somewhat of a limbo now are looking to do?
It is true across the country. And so what we're finding is that there is uncertainty. And in the case of uncertainty, it's not as though students are saying, gee, I'm not getting a straight answer from, you know, Arizona State, so I'm going to go to the University of Kansas. They're not getting good answers from anybody across the United States. And so they're looking at other countries. And so I think we've got to address it. We've got to sort of land the issue and get clarity around it, get predictability around it in the way I described. You know, it's essential to our balance sheet. So, you know, I mentioned that we're approaching 50% out-of-state students. The out-of-state students pay the full sticker price. You know, when you hear these, oh, there's $33,000 a year for out-of-state students, those dollars help support the student financial aid for Arizona students who I should add, are not being displaced because we admit every qualified Arizona student. But whether they can stay is often a function of their ability to pay, and those out-of-state and foreign students create the dollars that we can use to backfill the student financial aid needs that our Arizona students need. So it's important for our Arizona attainment goals, and it's important for our balance sheet, as well as for our national competitiveness.
All right. That is Fred Duvall, member of the Arizona Board of Regents. Fred, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
Since the war between Israel and Hamas broke out, American Jews have been bitterly divided in some cases. The debate has been particularly intense on college campuses, where students and faculty who participate in Palestinian solidarity actions have found themselves targeted for punishment by their own schools, and in some cases by the Trump administration. In the case of faculty members, a recent case at Muhlenberg College caught the attention of New York Times Magazine correspondent and ASU professor Sarah Vereen. Vereen wrote a piece for the magazine called "A Professor Was Fired for Her Politics, Is That the Future of Academia?" which tells the story of Mora Finkelstein. Finkelstein, who is both Jewish and an outspoken supporter of Palestine, taught a class on Palestine at Muhlenberg, which has a pretty significant population of Jewish students. Finkelstein also, critically, had tenure. And for a while, the school's leadership seemed to consider Finkelstein's activism to be an important part of campus discourse. But then, back in October of 2023, Hamas attacked Israel. The president of Muhlenberg condemned the attacks, and as Vereen wrote in her New York Times piece, that's when everything changed for Mora Finkelstein. Vereen spoke with my co-host, Sam Dingman.
After October 7th, the head of Muhlenberg sent out an all-campus email denouncing the attacks by Hamas, and Mora then replied all to that email, so sent a response that went to every student. Tell us what happened after that.
Yeah, so she said, you know, in some ways, this situation is more complicated than it's being made out to be, and she called Gaza an open-air prison and said a number of things in this sort of reply all to the campus. And that ended up being this sort of incident that kind of put her on the map in a larger way. From the people I talked to, it seemed to be not as much a student-driven charge to get her fired as it was alumni and outsiders.
Right.
There was a huge change.org petition started by some alumni, but signed by lots of outsiders calling on her to be fired. And so that original reply all email was one of the first ways that she sort of came to attention of people outside of the college. And I think really it was part of what led to then the really, really concerted campaign to get her fired after that.
Yes. Well, that is the part of this that's really interesting to me, is she sent this email, then she invited her students to have a frank discussion about it in the next instances of her class. You spoke to some of her students who said that those discussions were had and that they were, by and large, it sounds like, respectful and thoughtful and not necessarily inflamed in any particular direction. And yet, because of the publicity she had generated by virtue of sending this email, what she ends up actually getting fired for, if I'm not mistaken, is not the email or the things she said in the email, but an Instagram post, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are various administrators at colleges that have to sort of, when they field complaints about somebody like Maura in this case, they have to sort of decide, okay, when is something that she said, when does it make people feel unsafe versus uncomfortable? And I think that a lot of things that she said made people feel uncomfortable, either outsiders or students. But what the college said throughout the fall, she had various social media posts. She said, you know, she talked about the Gazan war in class. And there were lots of complaints, but the college always said, well, as far as we can tell, you know, doing our investigations, et cetera, the students are maybe uncomfortable by this, but they're not unsafe. And discomfort is actually a part of learning. And so then this all happened in the fall after October 7th. And the very, very start of the spring semester, Maura had come back home and was sort of watching the news from Gaza. And she's, you know, from talking with her, what she told me is that she's just felt very distressed over, you know, the rising death toll. So she was at home alone, and she reposted a Palestinian poet's post to her Instagram stories. It spoke specifically about Zionists, so those that support Zionism. And it specifically said we should exclude Zionists as we would any other racists. And so she reposted that without comment to her Instagram stories, and it was there for 24 hours. And in that time, the college saw it, and that was the reason she was investigated, the sole reason she was investigated, and also the sole reason she was fired.
Right. The origins of tenure, part of the thought process behind it was to make sure that things professors do in their private lives don't have bearing on their academic careers.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. I mean, not interesting for Maura because this was her life, but it's, you know, when we're thinking about these issues, is that what the college argued in the end was that because she said Zionists, which are people, and because she had students who identify as Zionists, that they could potentially read that repost as talking about them. And it's really messy because then, you know, I probably don't have time to get into sort of civil rights discrimination law, but, you know, there an ongoing part of the debate right now is also whether Zionist belief is part of a protected class. And this gets down to this question that the story is also exploring about Jewish identity.
One of the reasons it's interesting to me to hear about these elements of Maura's personality, where it seemed like she was really interested in figuring out exactly where the line was in terms of what she could speak about and post about, I suppose, as a member of the faculty, that would suggest to me, if I were, you know, sketching out a character profile in my mind, that she was going to be somebody who was going to fight for her continued ability to make those statements and publicize those ideas as a member of the faculty. But what happens at the end of your story is really remarkable to me, which is that even after she finds out that having been fired, there's going to be a review of her firing, she ends up resigning. Why did she do that?
Yeah. Well, so I think it's complicated. So what happened is that this faculty governance, this thing that's kind of essential to academic freedom, it had been sort of sidestepped by the administration, which is the real fear that schools will not adhere to this idea of faculty governance. And so they hadn't at Muhlenberg, but then they, in the end, there was this kind of review by the faculty, which is what we hope for in cases like this. And so that faculty group, this committee, they came back and they said, you know, this school messed up. It needs to be reconsidered. And the college president, in an ideal world, would sort of follow the guidance of faculty. But from the ultimate determination letter that the president had was going to release, it seems like she planned to reject the recommendations of her faculty committee, which means that Mora probably would have been fired. Mora, in some ways, was forced to resign.
But it does seem like she feels like she will be able to speak with greater freedom outside of the academy than she was within it.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it felt kind of like a tragedy. I think I say it near the end of the article that, you know, that decision of her to resign, I think probably being forced to resign, came after we saw all these attacks on higher education and various universities, including ASU, where I work. And also we were starting to see what they talk about as the brain drain. Like I talk in the story about how, you know, during the rise of Nazism in Europe, that we had so many amazing thinkers that came to the US because of these attacks on both freedom and academic freedom there and people's lives. But we're seeing what some people are calling a reverse brain drain, where people are leaving the US for colleges and universities in Canada or Europe, but people are also, and I've seen this from other professors I know, people are just leaving the academy. And so Mora in some ways is an example of that. This is somebody, yeah, she was forced out. I think that seems to be the case, but it's also that she's saying that those protections that have been there now for 100 years, they're no longer protecting faculty like they used to. And that feels to me like the scariest part of all of this.
Well, Sarah Vereen is Associate Professor of Creative Writing at ASU and a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine, where she published this piece that we've been discussing. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Around the world, the energy drink market is estimated to be worth billions of dollars. You don't have to look too far to see ads for drinks like Gatorade or Powerade. You also don't have to look beyond pretty much any grocery or corner store to be able to buy them. But my next guest says most of us don't need to be drinking these drinks, and for some of us, he says we probably shouldn't be. Matt Gross is a Brooklyn-based writer and editor. In a recent piece he wrote for the nonprofit news site Food and Environment Reporting Network, Gross argues, as the headline says, don't eat like a pro. Basically, he says, unless you're an elite athlete or taking part in endurance sports, you don't really need energy drinks and gels. Gross joins me to talk more about this. And Matt, as you write, these products are becoming more and more popular among people who are not big-time athletes. And I'd like to start by asking why you think that is.
Oh, that is a big question right there, the big why. Performance beverages have, you know, been around for about 60 years now, ever since the introduction of Gatorade in 1965, but they are just growing and growing and growing into, I think it's going to be about a $36 billion industry within a couple of years, which means it's not just elite athletes drinking this stuff. It is everybody. It's my 12-year-old daughter and people who don't get any exercise at all. And I think, I mean, there's a lot of reasons for this. I think we Americans like to have this idea that what we consume makes us better. This category is called performance beverages. Wouldn't you want to drink a beverage, Mark, that makes you perform better?
Absolutely.
Even if you never perform.
Well, so I guess like that's the question. Like, is it a psychological thing? Because, you know, at the risk of alienating, big performance drink and food, like I've had some of these and they don't taste amazing.
No, they don't. But they're sugary. We love
yes.
sugar. Right. I mean, we're human beings. We run on sucrose. These drinks have a lot of sucrose or sucralose, or some version of an easy-to-digest carbohydrate that our bodies want. And some salt, too, which our bodies also want.
Yeah.
And they come in cool colors. So what could be better than that?
Yeah. Well, so, and this sort of brings us to one of the points that you make in your piece, which is that these are beverages and foods that are designed to help elite athletes replace electrolytes or give them fuel, give them protein to keep running or keep doing what they're doing. But as you say, for some number of people who are eating or drinking these, who are not doing those athletic endeavors, it can actually be harmful to your body.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are, you know, essential nutrients, but if you consume too much of them, they are not going to be very good for you. There was a meta-analysis of, in 2023. That's an analysis of all of the existing medical literature on the subject. And that analysis concluded that you're really just better off drinking water if you're not an athlete. And that if you drink too much of this stuff, too much Gatorade, too much Powerade, too much aid, you know, it contributes to things like obesity, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and actually makes people smoke more, which is sort of interesting. But, you know, this is just not good for you if you are not engaged in the kind of activities that are going to burn up and use up all of those nutrients.
So is that the calculation that you have to do? Because, yes, your 12-year-old daughter enjoys Gatorade. My kids enjoy the occasional Gatorade or some of these other kinds of drinks. And, you know, while they are active and run around and play some sports, they are certainly not out running, you know, 5-10 miles a day or anything. So, like, do you have to sort of calculate how much energy are you burning? How many electrolytes do you think you need replacing before you decide if it's okay to drink one of these?
That kind of calculation, I feel like, can get a little too twisty and knotty. And as a runner, I try to avoid equating my actual exercise with very specific calorie burns, because there's a lot of eating disorder stuff that gets wrapped up in that. I just try to myself consume energy drinks or energy gels, one or two, if I'm doing something that is really exertionful. Is that a word? Exertionful. One of my former colleagues at Runner's World, Heather Meyer Irvine, who was the nutrition editor there, her rule of thumb was, if you are running for more than 60 minutes, then, you know, consider bringing an energy gel or an energy drink. But anything less than that, and you probably don't need that. I will go and run for, you know, 90 minutes on a hot day, and all I drink is water from the fountain.
Do you see a difference between energy drinks and the energy gels in sort of the, maybe even just the way that they're marketed? Like, I've seen commercials for Gatorade and Powerade and all those for many years. I can't remember seeing, for example, a TV commercial for one of these gels.
Well, yeah, I mean, energy drinks, you know, you can show a sexy athlete spattered with sweat and water, chugging a red or blue drink and looking awesome. There's no way to consume an energy gel that looks cool. They come in these little foil packets. You kind of got to squeeze them out. You don't really ever see them. I assume that Goo's Lemon Sublime flavor is vaguely yellow colored, but, you know, that stuff just comes straight out of the packet and into my mouth and into my stomach. It doesn't look good. So advertising that stuff is a bit of a trick. I don't think the marketers have quite gotten there yet. And frankly, the energy gels, they're not refreshing. They don't taste good. They taste worse than the energy drinks. Huh. But we runners, and I assume other endurance athletes, carry them around with us on these mega runs that we do because we need some calories along the way, especially during a race.
Well, does that make it maybe more of a niche kind of product for specifically runners or other endurance athletes, as opposed to maybe, you know, the mass marketing of energy drinks, which, you know, you can buy at any supermarket and you see, you know, as you said, Michael Jordan drinking them and any athletes drinking them? Like, does that maybe make it less common that you'll see the non-elite athletes using the gels?
Yes and no. I think you won't see non-athletes, you know, picking up a Goo or a Morton gel or a Spring Energy, you know, power packet. But what you do see is a lot of newer runners, people who, you know, have just gotten into it in the last couple of years, who think that they need lots of extra energy on what are often shorter runs.
I want to ask you about places like Phoenix, where, you know, obviously it gets extremely hot during the summer. And, you know, you talked about, you know, sort of that rule of thumb. If you're out, you know, running for maybe 60 minutes or more, then one of these gels or, you know, an energy drink might be worthwhile. But I wonder, in a place maybe that's undergoing a heat wave, or a place like Phoenix, which is particularly hot, does that maybe make it more acceptable if you're running for maybe, or exercising for a shorter amount of time, or spending more time outside, but not, you know, not an hour or so, to be using these products?
I think it's fine once in a while, but you mostly don't really need them. The studies keep showing that actually water is really going to do most of what you need it to do. You know, yes, you're going to need some electrolytes at some point. Yes, you're going to need to recover and consume some actual food. But water is the key to life. Get more of that. Put that back in your system before you do anything else. That's the easiest way to do it.
All right. Well, Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you, Mark.
Matt Gross is a writer and editor living in Brooklyn. Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. The second Trump administration has ushered in a sweeping overhaul of U.S. immigration policies. With the changes and challenges being rolled out so quickly, it can be hard to keep up. It can be even harder to consider the impact of all this on the actual people being targeted by these changes. But our next guest knows what it feels like. When D. Esperanza was 14 years old, he spent 5 months in captivity in the Tornillo Influx Facility in Texas. This was one of the provisional tent cities run by the U.S. government and its contractors, where the first Trump administration relocated underage migrants back in 2018. Esperanza recently published a book about his experience called Detained, A Boy's Journal of Survival and Resilience. It's the first memoir from one of the migrant children who was held in these facilities. It tells the story of Esperanza's escape from poverty in Honduras while searching for his parents as a teenager, only to be caught and imprisoned at Tornillo. Esperanza worked with Ivan Morales to translate the journal he kept during his detention. Morales is an activist and an immigrant himself who spent 6 months working at Tornillo, offering aid and emotional support to kids who were trapped there. My co-host Sam Dingman recently spoke with both Esperanza and Morales about the book and their collaboration. And just a note, Esperanza doesn't speak English fluently, so Morales helped interpret for him during the conversation.
Empecé a escribir para tratar de liberarme de lo que yo sentía por dentro.
I started writing to first liberate, free myself from what I was feeling and thinking inside.
Apenas era un niño de 13 años.
I was only 13 years old.
Y al no tener una forma de cómo liberar el estrés y las amenazas que tenía.
And I didn't have a way to process or free or liberate the stress or the threats that were taking place around me.
Dee, could I ask you to give us an example of something that you saw or experienced early on at Tornillo that made you want to write it down to help process it?
Me amenazaban a mí y a todos los niños que estaban conmigo.
They would threaten me and every other child that was with me.
Nos amenazaban con que si hablábamos fuerte, si jugábamos y nos parábamos de nuestras camas.
They would threaten us if we talked too loud, if we played with each other, if we even got out of our beds.
Nos amenazaban con que nos iban a dar un reporte, que era un reporte nos iba a afectar en nuestro caso de inmigración, que eso nos iban, por eso nos iban a deportar.
They would threaten us with a report, and to us, a report was told that it was going to affect our immigration cases and could lead to us being deported.
And as you were having these experiences and decided to start writing as a way of processing them, how did you hear the poems start to come into your head? Was poetry something you had always written, or was that a form of expression that you discovered in your attempt to try to process these experiences you were having?
No sabría decirte si era un talento que ya venía conmigo.
I wouldn't necessarily be able to say if it was a talent that I have had all my life.
Pero todo lo que se escribió y todos los poemas que escribí fueron porque salieron desde mi corazón.
But everything that I wrote and all the poems that I wrote were something that just came directly from my heart.
So, Yvonne, may I ask you, can you tell us how you came to be at Tornillo and how you first encountered D?
Definitely. So I myself am a Dreamer and DACA recipient. And so I came to the United States when I was 5 years old, and I became extremely passionate on advocating for human rights and immigration. And so let me take you back to the summer of 2018, where the news is reporting on the horrific family separations that are taking place. And there's kids in cages, and we're getting images of the Texas tent city, which is housing children in the middle of the desert. That was my call to take action. I couldn't sit back. I needed to figure out what I could do so that I could be there to help my immigrant community. And so I was deployed for 6 months as an emergency service reservist. And on my very first day, I had the privilege of meeting Di Esperanza along with 19 other children. I saw Di Esperanza's incredibly powerful talent with writing. I walked by his bunk bed. He was on the top bunk writing in his black and white composition notebook, his poem titled Somos Inmigrantes. And reading that poem, it brought me to tears. Years later, when he was an adult, we ran into each other again. And I told him, Di Esperanza, I still think about your poem and its effect it had on me. And he told me he still had his composition notebook that he wrote in while being detained. And I asked him for his permission to translate the poem into English and to look for a way to publish this story. That is what Detain is. Detain is a direct English translation of Di Esperanza's composition notebook.
Yeah.
So that now everyone can read it.
Yvonne, do you remember any of the lines from the poem that resonated with you in that moment?
The poem itself talks about the journey of what an immigrant faces. And so he captures the we. So it's not me, my experience, it's somos inmigrantes, we are immigrants. Mm-hmm. And it talks about what they do to get here. So they talk about jumping on top of trains and risking their lives, days of starvation, of seeing children and elderly on this journey to the United States, just looking for a better and dignified life. And there's resiliency in this journey. He talks about the fear of death, the fear of cartels, the fear of different cities in Mexico that are cities where essentially people go to die. And so
yeah,
it was a very powerful poem that just showed that all they're trying to do is get to the United States for a better life.
Dee, I'm very struck by the fact that right at the beginning of the book version, you write, I don't expect anyone to ever read this. I'm not even sure I'll ever reread it. What does it feel like to have your very personal poetry, your diary, out in the world?
¿Puedes hablar un poquito de cómo se siente tener tu historia publicada?
Me siento muy agradecido.
I feel extremely grateful.
El mensaje o el impacto que quiero dar con esto es...
The message or the impact that I want to come from this...
Que ya han pasado años desde cuando yo estuve ahí.
That even though it's been years since I was there and detained.
Y quiero que sepan que aún hay niños viviendo lo que yo viví.
And I want people to know that there is still children being detained living what he experienced to this day.
Niños más menores de la edad que yo tuve.
Children that are much younger than I, when I was detained.
La mía es solo una historia de las miles de bocas que han sido cerradas.
My story is just one of the thousands of stories that have been silenced.
Well, D. Esperanza is the author of the memoir Detained, A Boy's Journal of Survival and Resilience, a project that he worked on with Yvonne Morales. Thank you both very much.
Thank you so much for having us here.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. A reminder, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. Sign up for it at theshow.kjzz.org. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.